would like to welcome you to our first symposium in the scope of the Stakeholder Day on the NONET Loss Goal and the challenges of biodiversity offsets implementation. And I just want to make a very quick announcement that we had some changes to the program. You see in the program at 11:45 the talk by Coralie Calvet. It's announced as cancelled, and unfortunately Coralie can't be here, but Anne-Charlotte Vissière will give the talk of Coralie on her behalf. So please bear with us for that talk. But unfortunately, the talk at 12 by Julia Baker had been last minute cancelled, and we will have used this slot for some discussion instead. So with this, I think we will use the time, and we will start off with some introduction by Joe Bull and the global implementation of biodiversity offsets, and what do we know so far. So Joe, floor is yours.
Thank you, Marianne. This works? Yes, this works. Okay. Thank you, Marianne, and thank you for the introduction, and thank you all for coming to this first talk in this symposium. So, there it is. Good. So my name's Joe Bull, and I'm here to talk about what we know so far about the global implementation of biodiversity offsets. How many people here, can I see a show of hands, were in the plenary just a second ago with Ate Modenin? Okay, great. So you all saw that talk, which is really useful context for what I'm about to talk about. I'm actually also the Joe Bull that he mentioned by name. I need to give him 50 euros for that that mention later on. That's my compensation. So here's me camping at a natural biodiversity offset site in the middle of Central Asia. And what I'm going to talk about is the on-the-ground implementation of biodiversity offsets. That's the focus of my talk today. But first, I'm going to make what I think is an incredibly important point. And that's, if anyone ever tries to talk to you about offsets, stop them, tell them to stop immediately, and tell them first to tell you about avoidance measures. Because that's, whenever we talk about offsets, we should start with the context of avoidance measures, right? So the point of biodiversity offsets, for those who don't know, is that they aim to achieve this no net loss goal overall, as Ate very clearly explained, or sometimes a net gain. And the way you do that is you predict what you think the impacts of your development projects, whatever that is, a road or a mine, are going to be on biodiversity, and then you implement a sequence of actions to try and mitigate those impacts, right? And you start by avoiding wherever possible, then minimizing. So you try these preventative measures, right, to prevent the impacts in the first place before, as a last resort, you go on to biodiversity offsets. So prevention is always better than cure. So remember that. If people try and talk to you about offsets, stop them and ask about avoidance first. Now, I'm going to talk first quickly about the spread of policy for these kind of, you know, either no net loss policy or policies that have allowed the implementation of biodiversity offsets. And they've spread rather dramatically worldwide since the 1970s when they started. This is a paper by Martine Maron and colleagues. And what we see here is all the countries that have some kind of national policy in place that requires no net loss or biodiversity offsets, either in place or in preparation. That's 69 countries. There are more recent estimates that suggest there are up to 108 countries. So it's worldwide. The other panels here I won't go into in detail, but an important one to look at is this bottom right one here. And what that is that shows you all the countries that are eligible for IFC finance from the World Bank. So it's all the so-called developing countries that, you know, are eligible for big, you know, finance for big projects, right? And the reason that's important is because the World Bank has safeguards in place that require that those projects meet no net loss to get that money, right? So it's not just national policy that drives offsets. It's also the kind of finance for projects and sometimes voluntary commitments from big companies and so forth. I also just want to quickly mention this, a study from Nikki Shumway and colleagues, again in Australia. She did a recent study which looked at the kind of countries that have some kind of marine offsetting policy in place. So these are all the countries colored in blue. So it's worth remembering that this also applies to the coastal regions and the high seas, but there's far less implemented. another thing I want to mention before I go into the actual implementation side is the amount of research that's been done into biodiversity offset policies. So whilst policy has spread worldwide, there's also been a corresponding explosion in the amount of research done into biodiversity offsetting and related mechanisms. And Coralie Calvet and colleagues in France did a really nice study to look at a systematic review of the literature of biodiversity offsetting. And really, it's just to show that over the last few decades, as a proportion of Web of Science articles, the number that talk about biodiversity offsets has kind of gone up quite a lot. And also where it is, a lot in terms of the home institution for these pieces of research. A lot of it is in, you know, Australia, it's in Europe and in North America, and a few other countries, but that's kind of where a lot of the research is being done. I really want to make this point as well. A lot of the research that's done into biodiversity offsetting is theoretical research or conceptual research, right? There's very few kind of proper empirical studies into the outcomes of these projects. Now, I really hate to come here to Finland and potentially contradict one of the plenary speakers who is Finnish. That sounds like kind of conference and maybe career suicide. But I'm really interested to know, Ate, who in fact has just joined us, so maybe you can point it out in the questions, but mentioned a Canadian study that showed 99% net loss of wetlands. Now, I haven't seen that study, so I'd love to see it, and I'd love to know if, you know, where that study comes from. But as far as I know, there are very few studies that truly empirically show net loss or net gain. There are some, and I'll come on to those later. But the point I want to make is that we really don't have enough evidence to say whether offsets work or don't work, and that's the kind of area that I'm really interested in. And if maybe they don't work, maybe they do, but we just don't know. So getting on to implementation, excuse me. I think I drank too many of those conference beers last night. They're much stronger than you realize, right? But what a great conference that has its own beer. That's incredible. So I'm going to talk about three spatial scales of actual case studies into implementation. And the first I'm going to talk about is some single case studies, right? And there's quite a few cases where there's an academic paper or set of papers on a specific kind of offset case study that goes into detail and looks at whether it's succeeded or failed against different metrics. This is not the most beautiful slide in the world, but it's important to point out some of these, anecdotal case studies. And I think in particular, you can go back to 2012 and look at an Australian example. This is for the Sydney Olympic Park, where these guys say, yes, no net loss was achieved for this project, but only because there was a huge multiplier and there was much more frog habitat created in this case than was lost. You go to 2017, where Lindemeyer and colleagues did another example in Australia, which the title of that paper is Anatomy of a Failed Offset. So that gives you an idea what happened there. But then you move more recently. This paper is nice because it looks in the Peruvian Andes at the kind of a lot of the preventative measures, the avoidance measures and that kind of stuff associated with offsets, which, as I said, are the really important part. And finally, much more recently, we've had a couple of an emerging literature on the social aspects of this. So for a long time, a lot of the work into offsets was about technical aspects, area lost, area gained, restoration realities for wetlands, for example, those kind of questions, which are technical questions. But much more recently, we've had some interesting literature on the social dimensions of this, which ultimately is probably, as, if not more important. What are the impacts on people from doing these kind of policies? So the point of listing these is partly to pick out what I think are some really good case studies of empirical studies into specific offset projects, but these are all specific case studies. They don't tell you anything about offsetting in general, really. To do that, we can start looking at more kind of regional studies. And in North America, there's been a number of regional studies where, really a lot of offsetting. It's one of the first countries to adopt a no net loss kind of policy principle for biodiversity, and it does it for wetlands. So there's lots of wetland mitigation and wetland offsets in America. This map, incidentally, has dots for all the different kind of wetland restoration sites that have been created, wetland restoration or creation projects in the States through the kind of mitigation banking policy. And the reason I have this up here is partly to show how it's spread across the country, but also each of these points relates to kind of a specific regional study where there's been some empirical work into the restoration outcomes of these wetland offsets. And what they tend to show is, well, two things. One is that restoration is never 100% successful, and so there's never necessarily 100% no net loss in a lot of these cases. And secondly, so much depends on how you measure success in these projects. So you could say that the area of wetland is the same as the area lost, but as we all know in this room, because we're all ecologists, or a lot of us are, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. What's more important is the functional kind of the function of that wetland. And some of these studies have shown that you lose a lot of function in created wetlands over protected wetlands. So there's the kind of findings you get when you start doing this at regional scales, these analyses of offset projects. So that's North America. There have been some interesting studies in Canada as well, which I won't go into now, which show similar results. Another study I like quite recently is by Holly Nina and her colleagues, where she was looking at the actual implementation of marine offsets, kind of coastal offsets, in different parts of Australia. And the reason I show this is partly just because I think it's one of the few regional case studies for kind of actually testing the outcomes of offset projects. And it just shows how it's kind of the number of consents for projects with offsets has kind of gone up in recent years, but also the kind of sectors we're talking about. And a lot of these offset projects that have been studied in the literature relate to kind of big offset projects for, huge infrastructure projects or big extractive sector, mines or big oil and gas sites or pipelines and stuff like that. And I'll get onto why that's important in a second. But that's another study that's worth looking at. And then finally, from a regional point of view, myself and a couple of colleagues in this room, including Marianne, who's leading this symposium, and Astrid van Tiefelen and a few other people in the room tried to have a look at the implementation of offsets in Europe and see what we could find out about the implementation on the ground of these offset projects. One of the main things we found is that there's really not very many data available on the implementation on the ground of these offset projects. So what we have here is France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Sweden, which are four of the leading countries in Europe for biodiversity offsetting in practice, as far as we know. And again, the black dots kind of show you where all the kind of specific offset projects that we could find information for are available. Incidentally, the green areas are kind of the protected areas from the WDPA, from the World Database on Protected Areas, because we were interested in how many of these projects are actually implemented in existing protected areas, which is another whole discussion. But the point really from this study, our point was that the data available on the implementation of biodiversity offsets on the ground is really patchy, really not comprehensive, really not transparent. And that's important, especially because by law, a lot of these places should be reporting on this stuff. But also, how are we able to work out if these things work or not, which is effectively, ultimately what we want to do if we don't have any data on where they've been implemented and how. To give you examples, Germany, there's extensive, as Marianne mentioned in her question in the plenary, there's extensive implementation of biodiversity offsets in Germany, but we could only find information on implementation in a few of the provinces. Similarly for the Netherlands and for France, where there's only information from one province. So yeah, this is one of the key problems with this thing, and this is the point I want to keep coming back to in terms of our state of knowledge. We really don't know that much currently. My button stopped working. Oh, no, it didn't. Okay, so towards a global database a global analysis of biodiversity offsetting. Before I talk about the work that we've been doing, I want to mention this study by Laura Sonter and colleagues, which has come out very recently. And this is, again, where someone's tried to look at kind of an overview of offset practice around the world. And it's a cool paper. It's really worth reading. But again, the problem here is that what they've done is that they've taken a good data set, but it's a selection of 70 offset projects. And these are the big flagship projects, you know, the big ones that have received a lot of attention in the literature and so forth. Not all of these have actually been implemented yet, and not all of them have much information available about them. And then what the authors here do, which is really interesting, apart from pulling the data set together, is talk about how many offsets look at ecosystem services. Again, a point that was mentioned by Atte in his plenary. But the problem here is that, can you really draw generalizations about offsetting if you're taking a specific subset of offset projects and you have no idea what the broader kind of sampling frame is for offset projects? So in the final 2 minutes, I'm going to get on to what we've been doing the last couple of years, which is trying to create a bit of a sampling frame for kind of offsetting projects worldwide and look at where they've been implemented more generally. The next couple of slides have these little no tweet things. I like the idea that people might tweet some of the stuff I say anyway. But the reason not to tweet this is partly, firstly, because this is still in revision, this stuff, but also it's not 100% accurate yet because we're still revising some of the findings and making sure we can actually confirm them 100%. So don't see these as final graphs or final figures. But what this shows you out of the data set that we've compiled, and we've compiled a data set of around 7,000 offset projects around the world. So a couple of orders of magnitude larger than anything that's been compiled before. It shows you, first of all, where about 2,500 of those are located. And again, as you can see, a lot of those are up in North America, in Europe and Australia, down in South Africa. There are some important location data missing for Brazil and China particularly. But really this shows you where a lot of offset projects on the ground are actually found. And the vast, vast majority of these offset projects are tiny projects. You know, they're not the projects like Oyo Tolgo in Mongolia, which is something like an acts over 50,000 square kilometers, which is probably the biggest in our database. These are tiny projects for small wetlands, small farm holdings, that kind of stuff. And most offset projects are those. Also, the vast majority of offset projects are driven by regulation rather than by voluntary commitments or by finance requirements. So again, that's something to remember, thinking about the actual implementation of these things on the ground. And then finally, again, this is not a final figure, and it's something I'd rather you didn't disseminate yet. But this is starting to look at a breakdown of some of the information about those things. So I'm going to stop now and leave this up so you can ask questions about it if you like, because I've run out of time. But really, this talks about things like the total of the area of biodiversity offsets in different countries and the total number of projects, but also the kind of activity that it involves and the type of habitat. Now, yes, unfortunately, I've run out of time, so I can't finish my final slide on the way through. Oh, wow, that really was the end. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so thanks, Joe, for this talk, and that was right in time, and don't worry that you didn't have the chance for any questions from the audience, because we will, as I've said, we will have some time later on for some discussion. But now, without further note, we will move from this more general introduction and overview to a quite specific practitioner's view from the Swedish perspective, and with this, I would like to hand over to Torbjörn Josefsson and Arthur Grönberg for your presentation.
Thank you, Marianne. Anders, who is also part of the presentation, is not here. He's following us on Twitter. Both Åsa and I and Anders are practitioners working at a consultant firm called Energi Natur in Sweden, and we are also former researchers in ecology. We feel really inspired by Atte's talk today, this morning, and we are here to present some important aspects that need to be taken into account when implementing biodiversity offsetting. And these are based on our experiences as practitioners in consulting biodiversity offset projects carried out in Sweden during about the last 10 years. And we want to share our knowledge to facilitate biodiversity offsetting to be used as a good tool to mitigate biodiversity loss, primarily due to exploitation. And this is then to avoid offsetting to become a line of path for unsustainable exploitation, sometimes referred to as greenwashing. And thirdly, we want to inspire you for establishing closer contact between the practice and the research. During this presentation, we will go through four basic phases of offsetting projects. To each of these four phases, we will present some of the lessons we learned during the last 10 years. And please note that these different phases, the startup, the design, the implementation, and follow-up, they overlap in time. And especially in the beginning of a project, this can be seen as an iterative process when you go back and forth between the setup and the design.
Yes, so the implementation of biodiversity offsetting has been increasing in Sweden and also in Europe, as you've heard. Yes, and during the last years, several handbooks and guidance documents have been published, both by the Swedish government and as we heard, by the Finnish government too, EU, and also organizations as BBOP, which stands for the Business and Biodiversity Offset Program. Most of these documents, as well as this presentation, draws upon the basic concepts of offsetting that Atte was telling you about, and especially the mitigation hierarchy and the non-net loss concept, which stands for full compensation, as you've heard. And as mentioned, more and more biodiversity projects are conducted, but very few have a scientific component in them, at least in Sweden. So in this presentation, we want to highlight the possibilities and the gains that can be made with more scientific involvement in these projects.
So phase one, the startup phase. In Sweden, offsetting is sometimes required according to law and regulations, as well as in other countries, of course. But different sections of the law also requires different strictness of the compensation or an offsetting. However, there are also offsettings being carried out in Sweden voluntarily. But then whether or not it is possible to compensate for nature loss is both an ecological and a philosophical question. And we believe strongly that all projects should start out with such a discussion. Sometimes an operator decides to go forth with such a project, no matter the outcome of such a discussion. And as private persons, of course, but also as ecologists, we actually think that there are certain nature types that cannot be compensated for. But as practitioners in our job, we try then to minimize the damage as much as possible, and especially helping out with choosing the right offsetting strategy, primarily focusing on offsetting including the same nature types, but sometimes also replacing nature with other values or other nature types like compensating apples for pears.
So the lessons learned from this first phase that we want to present to you is, of course, that no net loss should be, every project should aim for no net loss, but one has to be realistic and realize that it's not always possible. And not seldom is this because of there is a trade-off between biodiversity and other ecosystem services, or there could be economic trade-offs and so on. Secondly, it can be very difficult to find a suitable area for offsetting that fits all these criteria that you're looking for. It has to also be able to acquire the land. So since this is a tricky question, the process with acquiring land has to be started early in the process. And our message to science then is that both operator and researcher should reach out early to make contact for to gain an optimal gain for both parties.
We move on to phase two, which we call the design phase. And during this phase, you choose the appropriate model for evaluation and calculation of damage and compensation. And this, the choice of model depends largely on the type and very much on the complexity of the project. For comparing the damaged area with the offsetting site, you need to collect environmental data, species data that can be measured. And then you use a quantitative approach and a quantitative model. Sometimes you also need qualitative data, and then it is often better to use a semi-quantitative method. This collected information then is used for a lot, including the base, the final choice of offsetting site. And during this phase, you also choose the, and design the methods and the action for restoration and management. And parallel during this whole phase, this data is then used for the scaling. That means balancing the loss and gain of nature values and biodiversity, and also, of course, designing the follow-up phase.
So our lessons learned from this phase is first that you, as Atte also talked about, that you always have to include the marginal when doing this balancing of the calculation, because it's always some uncertainties, both when it comes to time lag and when it comes to knowing what the losses will be and also the gains of restoration. Secondly, always have in mind to try to make ecological functionality over finding exact the same size and the exact name nature types. So ecological functionality should be more important, and also include the landscape approach if possible. And our message to science is that there is a lack of knowledge in the cost effectiveness of different restoration methods. And this draws upon the legislation concerning offset, how it's formulated. In most cases, there is a factor of fairness involved. So the required offset should be economically fair compared to the damage. And this draws upon that there is a need of cost-effective studies.
Moving on to the third phase, which is much more stringent and totally focused then on carrying out the actual restoration and management actions. But before that, of course, this question with land acquisition has to be, it should have always already been decided, along with setting certain agreements and getting the right permits. And then depending on the type of the project and the methods involved, this phase can be rather short, but most of the time it is quite long, especially when action has to be carried out several times or during several years.
So our lessons learned in this case is that it's good to include several methods and actions, not only one. Involves local stakeholders. They should have been involved in the early phases too, but it's good to involve them very much in the implementation stage too. And be aware that the transition between phase two and three might be very quick, because often the operator, when they got their operation permit, they want to, from the authorities, they normally want to get going very quickly. The message to science then is to apply for external money, and this is since the operators seldom are willing to pay the extra cost for the thorough and extended follow-up that science requires.
So, during the final phase four, the follow-up phase, both the way actions have been performed and, of course, their actual effects are monitored. And this must be thoroughly evaluated. Sometimes, or I would say quite often, actions are required to be done several times to reach the goal of the offsetting. This can be seen as an ongoing process that can be quite extensive, especially when dealing with nature types and species response that has very long deliverance times, like, for instance, old-growth forests and so on.
So this phase, the follow-up phase, is perhaps the most important phase, especially today when we use the use of biodiversity offsetting is increasing very rapidly. This is also what Jo was telling about. So if this is done very thorough, both the setup, the collection of the data, documentation, and especially the communication, the results from this follow-up will contribute directly to the common build-up knowledge, the knowledge build-up, which is really important for this to become useful in the future. And the follow-up ambitions, but one should be aware of that the follow-up ambitions really goes beyond the goals of the individual offsetting when it comes to each separate project. So the message to science is share your results outside the academic world and do it very quickly because we need it as a consultants.
So some final take-home messages for you. Knowledge sharing and close contact between different stakeholders, including the operators, the practitioners, and authorities, form the basis for a successful implementation of offsetting. And especially considering the complexity and the variety of conditions under which offset projects often develop. This requires a fully transparent process with contact with the landowners early on, and that researchers are involved already during the startup phase. For operators, engaging researchers is a way to secure high-quality monitoring and evaluation. And then for the researchers, of course, this is actually a great opportunity for large-scale projects and startup funding. And then, of course, on a more general level, this knowledge gain is very important for reaching strategic environmental goals and objectives, both on a national but also on a European level. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Asa and Torbjörn. We may have time for a very quick question if you raise your hands. Anyone? Yes? Behind. Very quick.
Yes, knowledge sharing is a key issue. I think it should work both ways. I guess there is much information on grey literature in the offices and agencies and consultants that could be used for science as well.
Yeah. Thank you, very true.
Okay, so now moving from a Nordic country a little bit more south, and next up we will have Anne-Charlotte Vissier, and she will present no net loss from the French perspective, no net loss of wetland functions.
Thank you, Marianne, for organizing the symposium. I'm Anne-Charlotte Vissier, working at the CNRS in France in the University of Paris Sud. And I will be presenting results I have been conducted with colleagues from the Alpine Ecology Laboratory and also from the Consultancy Biotope. Here we have been working on a scenario-based modeling at the scale of a whole territory, and we have compared the consequences of these different models and scenarios of biodiversity offsetting on the likelihood to reach the no-net loss of wetlands function goal. A quick story of how a non-net loss goal appeared in France. It wasn't in the oldest law that includes mitigation hierarchy and biodiversity offsets, which was the law on nature protection in the late 70s. The first time the non-net loss goal appeared on French texts was at the beginning of the years 2010, and it was on document that the Ministry of Ecology proposed to improve the way the mitigation hierarchy was implemented, but at that time it wasn't endowed with legal forces. And the first time the non-net loss of biodiversity goal is endowed with legal forces is in the last law on biodiversity, which was voted on 2016. And in that law, what is interesting for us is that it is detailed that biodiversity offsets have to take into account species, natural habitats, and also ecological functions. So that's why here in that work we are interested in the function-based approaches of offsets and not only the surface-based. Our case study is a region around a city which is in the Alpine region. The city is Grenoble, and we are really conducting an approach at the scale of this whole territory. So we try to go beyond the project, the usual project-by-project approach of biodiversity offsetting. We are using a specially explicit modeling method, and our wider research question is to analyze the consequences of implementation and assessment method on the ecological efficacy of biodiversity offsets. Our works are based in on results from a previous project that was conducted by the Alpine Ecology Laboratory. This research group, they modeled the land use change of the Grenoble area during a certain period of time, which was 2009-2039. However, they did not take into account that their model would impact wetlands on this territory. So I propose to add an additional module on this modeling to also model the biodiversity offsetting of these impacted wetlands that were impacted by the model. So we are here in a modeling work. To do so, we are starting from outputs from the land use change model. First, we have to prepare a map of the wetlands that have been destroyed by the model during the modeling period. Then we are preparing a second map where we would have all the wetlands that could be used to compensate for the impacts. So these are all the wetlands that would be eligible on the 2039 map. After that, the game of our model is to pick up on the map too as much as wetlands as necessary to compensate for the impacts that have been identified in the map one. But how to measure the offsetting need of this first map? You could have, like a lot of countries did before and are still doing, just having a surface-based approach to do it. But also, we wanted to analyze this from a function-based method approach. So that's why we had to create a scale to measure the quality of the wetlands that were impacted and those that were restored. So in collaboration with an ecologist and with an agronomist, we create this scale. The idea is to have a quality of the map one and also a quality of the map two here, where you have the wetlands that could be used to compensate for the impacts made on the map one. So here you have the very detailed land use of the Grenoble territory, which was done by the previous project. But here you can see that these are only land use linked to agricultural areas, because this is linked to our case study. All the wetlands are located in agricultural areas. And for each very detailed land use, here are different rotations, you'd have a score. For instance, here in this map, it was worse to impact a permanent grassland than to impact a spring monocrop, for instance. On the other map, if the model pick up a permanent grassland, it's like there is nothing to do because it's already a quite good quality habitat. But if the model take a spring monocrop, it will bring a better ecological lift from an ecological restoration of this parcel. Then here you have the two maps together. The principle of our model is to take all the necessary green areas to compensate for the red ones. And of course, you can see here that if you want to compensate, for instance, this very intensive area, it was a good quality area. If you take very light green places, you will need a lot of surface. Whereas if you take, for instance, this parcel, it maybe you would need less surface to compensate for this impact. We are here assuming that these areas are ecology equivalent. Of course, it's a bit of a simplification because you have lots of different types of wetlands. For our model, we have some rules that would be the same for all the scenarios. These rules are that we are remaining on subcatchment, which means that all the offsets for some impacts in one subcatchment have to remain on the same subcatchment. And also, we prefer when the offsets are located on ecological corridors is to follow the French guidelines of the green and blue veins public policy. Now, our scenarios are created based on a combination of several implementation methods and of several assessment methods, the surface-based and the function-based methods. Here are the four scenarios. The first one is an old approach of offsetting, where the only objective is that you have a 1.2 ratio, which it means that you have to compensate twice the size of the parcel that has been impacted. So the model would pick up randomly some parcels until reaching this 200% of the impacted surface. Another scenario is the rules of the local river basin plan of this region. Here, the objective is that the model would choose, it would prefer to take first the areas with the highest ecological value until reaching 100% of the impacted surface, and then it will pick up randomly other parcels until reaching 200% of the impacted surface. Then we have choose to create a new scenario, which would be based on the fact of selecting the highest value parcels first until reaching the non-net loss of function. And if you do not have reached the 100% surface of the impacted surface, at least you have to continue until reaching this objective. And the last scenario is the same principle. However, we do it by hand, so it's not a model here, it's really doing by hand, like if I was an environmental consultancy trying to help people to do aggregated offsets, which means that all the parcels have to be contiguous, next the one to the others. So what are we following now when we are modeling these different scenarios? We are following two indicators. The first one is a surface ratio, and the other one is an ecological function ratio. And because we have run 5,000 simulations for each of our four scenarios, we have this kind of graphs where you would have a representation of each of the indicators. And we also conducted sensitivity analysis to check some methodological choices we have made. Now the results. For the first scenario, which is the old-fashioned way to do offsets only looking at the surface, our results show that actually, here is the result for the surface, here for the function, With this method, we would go toward a net loss of ecological functions at the scale of the whole territory of Grenoble. Here it means that we have aggregated the results of each subcatchment. Then, with the river basin plan scenario, we showed that actually we outreach the objective of non-net loss function. It means that at least we should be more likely to reach this objective. With the scenario that we have created, we show that we also at least reach the non-net loss of wetland function objective, but with using less surface. And with the aggregated approach, we show that also we slightly outreach the objective of non-net loss of function, but with a bit more surface. Of course, here it's only modeling, but we can see that the surface-based only approach doesn't seem to be relevant. Now it's a question of choosing or maybe having complementary methods with the function-based approach. It seems to be better. After, it's a question of surface, and of course there is a high pressure on the acquisition or renting of land for offsets, so that's maybe something interesting to see. What we did not take into account in these results are other advantages of aggregated method. For instance, here you can see that there is only one parcel to monitor and to control, so for regulators it's better organized. And also there are ecological advantages. For instance, here we were able to reconnect an ecological corridor because all the parcels are contiguous. So we also have other interests that could tell us that it's also a good idea to have this approach. So here are my conclusive messages. To complete this study, we must take into account other consequences, pros but also cons of aggregated offsets. Maybe a good idea is actually to have a balance between case-by-case and aggregated approaches of offsets because, for instance, for some very specific wetlands, you cannot say, okay, I will compensate it, but several kilometers away. Of course, our method is not a method to size offsets, but it could be useful to have a very rapid assessment of the ability of a territory to carry the developing project and also their offsetting. So it's a way to see if a non-net loss is feasible. And if it's not, maybe we have to reconsider a development. Regarding the generalization of our findings, maybe it's not completely possible at the scale of Europe or even at the scale of France, because some land use policies are different between regions, and also the agricultural land use is a bit different between regions. And to finish, this is a theoretical geographical approach, of course. We had very high quality data to do this study, but we did not take into account some ethical and socioeconomic aspects. For instance, farmers wouldn't agree to give their lands like that, so because it's modeling, we did not take this into account. This is a perfect transition to the next presentation. So, and of course, we did not take into account that some of the measures we have picked up maybe wouldn't be successful. So this should change a bit the results of the non-net loss of objective. Maybe it's not outreached, but it's just respected, at least. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Anne-Charlotte. We again have time for a very quick question or comment. Yes, up there.
Hello, just like a legal question. So in France, if you then have this area that becomes the positive area where you make the gains or minimize the loss, what protects that from being developed further on? Like, is there something in law saying, okay, it's been 50 years?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you anymore, so we can have a discussion later.
Thank you.
Okay, so just as a short reminder, please keep your questions, because right after the next presentation, we will have a free 15-minute slot where we will invite all the speakers up here, and you can challenge them with your questions. So now up here, you see the presentation by Coralie, but you still see Anne-Charlotte up here, who will, on behalf of Coralie, present you an example, an empirical offset study from southern France.
Yeah, so Coralie Calvé is sorry she couldn't make it for the conference. She is an environmental economist at the University of Montpellier. And here with other colleagues from INRA and also, again, the consultancy Biotop, they have a reflection about the involvement of farmers to implement biodiversity offsets with a case study in the south of France. In France, lots of biodiversity offsets are implemented in agricultural land because it's an important land use in France. So very often, the developers would acquire the land to carry ecological restoration by themselves. But this often leads to social conflicts and to a perception by farmers and some agricultural organizations that there are at least a double and even a triple punishment here, because first, the land is used by the development. Also, it is used, the agricultural land is used by the development, by the ecological compensation of the development, and at the end, there is an increase of the price of this agricultural land. So an alternative could be to involve farmers to do the biodiversity offsets on behalf of the developers. The question the authors here raise is, what are the pros and cons of using what they call the agri-biodiversity offset schemes, ABOs, so it's involving farmers to implement non-net loss policies. The first question they raise is, what are the main reasons why farmers would enroll land in ABOs? The second question is, how to assess the effectiveness of these ABOs? And here, the effectiveness would be assessed by the ability to reach the non-net loss objective. Here is a short explanation of the different stakeholders involved in this ABOs system. You have the developers having a development project, reaching to ecological losses after having respected avoidance and reduction steps, if the works are well done. Then, in this example, the developer won't acquire land, but they would ask farmers, one or several, to carry out the offsets on their behalf, and sometimes they are helped by intermediaries. Then the farmers would conduct the offsets, which are here land use or practice changes, with the aim of providing ecological gains that are supposed to be ecologic equivalent to the ecological losses. When we are in the context of mandatory offsets, you also have regulators who would permit the development project and that would check if, for instance, the ecological equivalent is respected, and also other important criteria, such as the fact that the measures the farmers would do are really additional compared to what they were doing before, and, for instance, that the ecological gains last as long as the ecological losses linked to the project. Here are information about the case study. This is a story of a high-speed railway line that was built in the south of France to avoid two cities, Nîmes and Montpellier. Unfortunately, this project has significant ecological impacts on the habitat of the little bustard, which is a bird living in Mediterranean open areas. Around 2,000 hectares of this species' habitat are impacted by the project. The developer has hired an environmental consultancy to create a method to help them assessing the ecological losses and gains linked to the project and to the offsets of the project. And the principle of this compensation unit method was to to be based on habitat quality. So here the question is to measure the habitat quality for the little bustard before and after the project at the impacted sites, and before and after the compensation at the offset sites. Here is an illustration for the offsetting part. If a farmer restores an ancient industrial orchard to an open area that is relevant for the little bastard, he would receive more credit, more compensation units per hectare than if he only changed his practices on an already opened area, because it's already something not so bad for the little bastard. But here it's a bit better. So after this calculation, more than 3,000 credit compensation units have to be created to compensate for the residual losses of the project, and this should last 25 years. Here, these ABOs are not only realized by one farmer, but by several farmers. So there is a local farmer union-run body that is organizing this group of contracts. And they have to make sure that each year you have enough farmers involved in these ABOs to provide this amount of units and during these 25 years. These contracts are 5 years long. There are 11 different measures that the farmers can decide to implement on their land, and there is a fixed payment. Currently, more than 1,000 hectares are under contract, and this involves 80 farmers, and also the developer, besides, he acquired 500 hectares to conduct also himself some ecological compensations measures. Okay, so now the authors, they sent more than 1,000 questionnaires to farmers that were actually invited by the CNM project to unroll land in ABOs. They received 151 answers, of which 121 were analyzable. And among these answers, there were 40 farmers that actually decided to implement ABOs. When they were asked to do it by the CNM project. But to be sure that all the farmers would answer the same question, they asked them what they would do if we proposed them to do some ABOs in the coming years. And they analyzed their results using an ordered logit model, which is an econometric model. Results for the question one about the ABOs acceptability. Here is a table of all the reasons why farmers would or would not accept to enroll land in ABOs, and it's sorted in a descending order of significance. You can see here that what is the most important for farmers in this study is that the measures are easy to implement. It's the most important thing. Then they like to withdraw the measure if they want to. Also, they like to have confidence on the contracting parts, which are here the developer and also the local union farm body that is organizing the offsets. And the social norm is important. Here, it means that they like if other farmers do also some ABOs. Here, it means that farmers that are not in a very good financial wealth like these measures, because for them it's kind of a diversification. Then usual socioeconomic factors also have a role. For instance, they like the measure that are well paid. Young people are more willing to do the measures, and better educated people also accepted these measures. And the least, and the last one is something not so significant. It's when a farmer is already interested in protecting the environment, maybe it will be a bit more willing to do this measure, but it's not very significant. Then results of the question two. For this question, only the answers from the 40 farmers that actually are already implementing ABOs are analyzed here. And this is the half of the total number of farmers actually doing, the ABOs for the CNM project. Here, they want to check if the additionality and compliance criteria of biodiversity offsets are really respected. So they ask them some questions. First, they ask them what kind of practice changes they would agree to do. And here, unfortunately, we can see that a great part of them declared that they would prefer to do no change or very low changes. Other question, they ask them what would be the main criteria to select the plots on which the offsets would be implemented. And again, this is bad news because most of them explain that actually they would prefer to do the offsets on the areas where the practices are already implemented. So here it's completely no change. When you combine these results with the previous results of the fact that farmers like when they have to do the measures, when it's very easy to implement them, actually all of these results let the authors reveal a potential windfall effect in this case study, and of course a problem of compliance. Another criteria they studied is the permanence of the measures. They ask farmers if they would agree to continue to do the practices after the end of the contract, which means when the 5 years stops, if they do not continue the ABOs, would they go back to their previous practices? And the answer was a yes for, sorry, the answer was a yes for, sorry, a bit more, one third of the farmers. So here again, this is a huge limit of this approach because we would have a very limited sustainability of these ABOs in time. A few conclusions of this work. The very question was, are ABOs a good idea for non-atlas policies or not? This study showed that maybe it could facilitate the implementation of offsets, especially on land when there is a high pressure on the fact of acquiring lands, which is the case for the agricultural land. But to do so, you need to have a good acceptability from farmers. So they have worked on this, and they showed that the acceptability is mainly driven by the easiness for implementing or for withdrawing the measures. Trust on the contracting parties is also important. The social norm plays also a role, and at the end, the farmer's level of wealth also is a driver. But when we look at the French law on biodiversity, which has been voted quite recently, developers have now an objective of results for the offsets, not only an objective of means, which means that now the offsets are supposed to be really effective. But the authors showed that actually there is a strong information asymmetry between the farmers and the developers, which poses huge challenges in terms of compliance and additionality, because we showed that farmers would prefer to do nothing or very few changes to accept some ABOs. So the authors propose to strengthen the controls and sanctions, but not only for the farmers, also from the developer side. And it could be a good idea to better define the criteria for selecting the plots on which the offsets would be realized. And last problem is the limited permanence. Maybe an idea is to have long-term contract, but unfortunately in France, lots of farmers are only renting their land, so they cannot sign very long-term contracts. An avenue for research would be to consider the use of conservation easements that have been added in the last law on biodiversity to help some measures that are linked to the land to be realized, whatever is the owner or the user of this land. Thank you for her.
Thanks, Anne-Charlotte. We can have a quick question, and then we will directly, after the music, move into the discussion.
Yes, right there. Thank you. My name is Eva Prima. I'm from Finland. How well do we know these farmers, and have they engaged in some kind of co-learning processes where they would actually learn about these news?
Thank you.
okay, so we just figured that it's actually quite nice that we are going to have some improvised panel discussion here. But first of all, as we had very little time for questions to the presenters beforehand, I would like to hand over to you, and I would just very briefly like to introduce you to Valérie Dupont from University of Louvain in Belgium, and she's giving the next talk right after this discussion. But first of all, the floor is all yours for your questions, comments, and discussion points. Yes, up there. With a gray sweater, there was a comment, right? Yeah, there, please.
I just thought I'd ask my question again because there's time now. So basically what I asked was if there's any legal framework, for example, in France, but in any other country already, for how long these offset sites need to be protected for, because obviously if you just go and do something great to a site and restore it and it gets developed 2 years after, then the gains aren't, you know, going to be nothing, and the exercise is pointless. So I just don't know anything about the actual legal process of these offsets. It would be nice to know how that's taken into account.
Yeah, actually, this is a great limit of our system so far, is that so far the offsets were lasting several years, just 4 or 5 years, something like that. And now with the more recent project, it's a bit longer. And now we are... We have projects that are supposed to be offset during 25, 30, 40 years, but still, from an ecological point of view, it's not enough, and we are absolutely not sure what these land would become after the offset is finished. So this is really a limit, and we do not have a perpetual conservation easement, like it's the case in some other countries. So we are really, yes, for us it's a problem, and we do not know how we would solve this situation. Maybe one thing could be that because these areas would have been restored and maintained in an ecologically interesting state during 30 years, it will be difficult to impact them, but we are not so sure.
Can I comment on that too?
Yeah, yes.
Just give some perspective from a Scandinavian point of view. Like, for instance, in Sweden, there's a limit for how long you can establish such agreements of 50 years. And that might sound like a long time, but this, for instance, when you're working with old-growth forests, 50 years is a very short time. In order to restore into a more natural ecosystem with pine and spruce, you need much longer periods than 50 years, but the legislation set that limit as it is now.
Okay, thanks. Next question from the audience. What's down there, please?
Thank you. Hi, it's just an additional information to what you just mentioned, just that the French law on biodiversity says that the compensation measures must last as long as the impact lasts. But there is a major gap between what we can do, like 25 years, and talking about right-of-way, how do you measure the length of the impact in time?
Yeah, maybe an additional, it's true, what is problematic here is that because the liability of the success of the measures are tied to the developer, we also have a problem to follow this developer for a very long time. Sometimes you have the organism that is doing the railway, and then you would have another organism that would manage the land, the railway, for the very long time. And also that's one reason for it's difficult to follow the developer for a very long time.
Okay, I guess there was another question over there, Eva.
Hi, so I'll also repeat my question, and then I have another one to Joe. But the question was that I somehow, from the study on the landowners, I got the feeling that maybe the landowners don't know much about this practice, and I was interested to hear how they have learned about it. So I got a feeling that they just want to maintain their status quo, and it might not be the case if they learned more about what the offsetting is about. So I'm interested in that. But then I'll just use the opportunity to ask Joe what is implementation? It was a really nice presentation of what we see about offsets all over the world. But I'm actually someone who I would frame my work as I study implementation. So I study the practice of putting resources, learning to do things, organizing, giving responsibilities, mandating, and this sort of thing. And I'd like to ask you how you study implementation in more detail than what you had the 15 minutes to tell us about. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for the question, and it's an important one. What do we mean by implementation? I mean, so what we did with that study in particular was we, first of all, tried to do a systematic review of all the kind of offset projects that have been kind of somehow designed or there's some detail on, and then we took all the ones that there's some kind of evidence, either documented in the grey literature or the academic literature or government registers or so forth, that they've actually started, right? So it could be that they've only just started. There could be the first spade in the ground or whatever. But the point is to say, when we say implemented, we mean projects that have not only been designed and there's some specific details on, but we have some documented evidence that they've actually begun and are in process. Now, obviously, one of the problems there is that we haven't, you know, the project team that did that work, none of us have actually gone to all 7,000 offset sites and, you know, checked what was actually happening on the ground. And I think that's a really important distinction between what we're doing and what, you know, a true study of implementation would be, to take a sample of those projects and find out how many, you know, what the actual outcomes on the ground are of those projects. But in terms of the study we did, it was about documented evidence of some kind of activity, and not some kind of activity just vaguely, you know, some detailed specific activity that had begun. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so kind of like the disciplinary background where I come from, that what you are studying is impact. Right. And I am studying the process, and I am really, really keen to learn, and I have read in some work that you have been involved in that you all have also somehow addressed implementation as a process, the types of activities that might generate more success than not. But yeah, good. Thanks for the clarification.
And just for the question about the other study, I do not know if they ask the degree of knowledge of the farmers about offsets. So I would recommend to contact Coralie or to read the paper they have written about that.
Yes, right. Next.
Thank you. In Portugal, we are having a big debate with the business companies and the national government, the protection agencies, on how to assess effectiveness of offset, because the little bastard is a good illustration. So imagine that you have to manage a given amount of hectares as suitable habitat for this bird. And business companies, consultants have to invest the funding to achieve a given target in terms of hectares or in terms of habitat quality. But imagine that in spite of that, the target bird population declines. So was the measure effective or not? Is the business company accountable for that decline? Or so what we call the direct versus indirect impacts. So how to evaluate effectiveness in this theoretical example?
So the whom do you address specifically, or you address the whole panel of it?
I have an example of that. One of the big offset projects in Sweden, it's the offset of a railway outside Umeå in northern Sweden. And there they had this problem because it was the impact was on migratory birds who stay there during a certain time of the in the spring. And they tried to at least address this question by looking at other sites along the coast to see the population change in other places compared to this site. So that's sort of a way they at least try to.
You want to add to this?
Yeah.
Joe?
Yeah, I think it's a really important question. I hope I made the distinction in my talk clear that I was talking about implementation or impact, as our colleague says, versus actual effectiveness. And it's such an important question, the effectiveness. Two points I just want to make on the effectiveness of offset, of biodiversity offset projects. The first is obviously there's a huge amount of work to be done around counterfactual thinking. There's a symposium, I think, happening after the break, or tomorrow, sorry, in the morning, looking at counterfactual thinking. So the really key question is what would have happened in the absence of the offset? And that's what we need to measure it against. So that's the first thing to consider, I think, when talking about effectiveness, is what's the alternative scenario. I think Ate mentioned this in his kind of excellent talk covering all the different issues with offsetting. So the counterfactual is one. The second one is, again, going back to the mitigation hierarchy. And if we really want to know the true effectiveness of biodiversity offset policies, we really need to understand what impacts have been avoided because they exist. So to what extent have biodiversity offset policies cause developers not to impact things in the first place? And that's the really hard thing to find out, because to do that, we have to know what the intention of the developer was in the first place. We need to know what the intention was at the start of the development project, and we need to know how much they've changed their behavior as a result of the biodiversity offset policy. So I think there are two things looking at effectiveness, it's such an important question, but counterfactuals and avoided impacts, I think, are two key things we need to look at.
Yes. Further questions from the audience? Yes, up there.
Thank you. Talking about effectiveness, I think there's also the issue about the fact that the environment is dynamic, and therefore, if we're looking at long-term effectiveness, you know, shouldn't we be taking things like climate change into account? And it might not necessarily be effective to restore something to as it is at present, but we need to be thinking 25 or 50 years into the future. Are any biodiversity offsets doing that?
I can jump in, yeah. Of course, this is something that researchers are now saying, that we have to take into account the trajectories of the places that were destroyed and those that would be restored. It's important. And the climate change is also another huge challenge here to take into account. From the French perspective, I can say that since very recent changes in the environmental impact assessment text, we have now to write on the environmental impact assessment this trajectory of the impacted and restored site. We have to give references for these sites. But of course, this is something very difficult, and it's not well implemented so far. But at least it is on the texts now.
Okay, any final questions from your side? Okay, if not, I think we have just a few minutes left, then maybe we can have some final statements. And I would like to use the opportunity to ask a few questions myself. First of all, Joe, you've talked a lot also about this implementation aspect, and in prior work a lot, done a lot of research on the technical details on additionality and such. But now I have the feeling that we're very much dealing with implementation, follow-up, and so on. So, but still we haven't really solved these old problems. So where are we now with our offsetting research after a number of years? Are we digging into implementation, or are we still getting our hands dirty with the technical details?
Oh, that's a big question. Thanks, Marianne. Yeah. No warning at all. Okay, I mean, I think it's an
Oh no.
What a disaster.
Yeah, so we let you out of this.
Thank you.
Okay, so thanks for discussing with us. And I forgot to mention a little bit of self-promotion, that a number of the issues that have been that we've discussed and the perspectives from different countries over Europe are also present in this recent book on biodiversity offsets and different European perspectives, and you will find some information on this outside. But now I would like to give the floor to Valérie Dupont, who will give a little bit of a perspective from Belgium on the legal aspects of biodiversity offsetting and no net loss.
Hi, everybody. I'm really glad to be here. So I'm Valérie Dupont from Belgium. I'm finishing a PhD in law on the design and implementation of biodiversity offsets and habitat banking scheme with a comparative analysis of the legal framework that are in place in the United States, Australia, the European Union, and more recently, Brazil. So just a quick question, is there any lawyer in the room? Okay, there's a few. Well, I'm still gonna try to make it very simple so everybody can understand it. So my goal today is from my PhD research to look more at enforcement tools and how to make sure that biodiversity offsets become effective. So I want to focus the talk on four main questions. Why enforcement is important? Who are the responsible parties and stakeholders? What enforceable offset obligation? And then the last one in how, what tools to implement for what type of non-compliance. So why? Why is it important, and what's the goal of enforcement? So enforcement, so the problem with implementation issues, so we've seen there's a lot of research on the design aspect and the technical aspect, not as a few research as Joe showed on implementation. But what if implementation does not occur and offsets remain like on paper, or there's inadequate implementation or measure unsuccessful, and there's not a lot of long-term management and protection of the sites? That's where enforcement comes into play. So we know in species protection, the dictum, shoot, shovel, and shut up. If there is no enforcement, why would I respect my obligation, especially as it's additional costs? So the first objective of enforcement is to deter non-compliance and to incentivize people to actually implement biodiversity offsets. The second major function that I want to highlight here is remedying effect. The ultimate goal is to have ecological success of the measure and to have a no net loss. So if, for example, even if you implemented all of the measure but are still not successful from an ecological point of view, what is the enforcement mechanism to remedy that situation? So to show how important enforcement is, there's a lot of developments, and especially, for example, if you look at the Environmental Impact Assessment Directive that was recently amended, it now has a specific article that, has a specific article that asks member states shall ensure that the offsets are implemented by the developer. So it's kind of interesting that you have to have in a directive a provision, especially on making sure that member state and implement and enforce biodiversity offsets. The recent French law on biodiversity also has a lot of provisions specifically tailored at enforcement, and I will talk about this measure later on. So who, by whom biodiversity offsets should be implemented, and against whom? Again, that depends on the type of offset scheme we are in. So I'm mostly interested in regulatory schemes, meaning that biodiversity offsets are required by a competent authority as part of a permit process. But as Marianne will discuss after me, there's also a lot of cases of voluntary biodiversity offsets or offsets required as part of conditional loans. And those enforcement authorities and enforcement strategies would be completely different as if we are in the case of public authorities. The second point is who within public authorities, whether it's mandatory or not. So if you have a regulatory scheme, Sometimes public authorities have to require biodiversity offset from developers. Sometimes they have a discretion. If you are in this kind of discretionary scheme, there's also a bigger discretion in the enforcement of biodiversity offsets and in the enforcement tools. The last point that I want to raise here, it's the mandate, the prerogative, and the resource that each of these competent authorities have. For example, local authorities do not have the same enforcement power or enforcement resource as federal or federated authorities, and that's something to be reminded of when we speak about enforcement. The second point is against whom. Again, so in the first, usually biodiversity offsets are implemented on a case-by-case basis, which is also called permittive responsible offsets. In this situation, you have a public authority that required through a permit to permit is to implement biodiversity offsets, and then that permittee or developer will either implement it himself or herself on the land that they own, or they will subcontract to landowner, land manager, ecological consultant. You can have a series of different stakeholders that are involved in the implementation per se of the offsets. There is no legal relationship between the public authorities and these stakeholders, meaning that the public authority always have to go through the permittee, which then, through private law contracts and enforcement means, will have to require the stakeholder to implement it. So, for example, when we saw in the previous presentation, if you have a farmer that says that we'll implement it and then do not implement the commitment that he took, well, the public authority cannot go against the farmer. It has to go against the developer in the middle. And so that's an important thing to think about in terms of enforcement. So in order to resolve that issue and also to have mostly economies of scale, there's habitat banking schemes that have been developed, and it reverts the legal relationship between the offset supplier and the local and the public authorities. So the idea is that you have a bank sponsor that create what we call a habitat bank. So they usually compile land, restore it, and they create credits, and they can sell the credits to the developers. In principle, selling credits make that the responsibility is transferred to the bank sponsor, and the developer is released from its obligation as soon as he buy credits. So that's except in France, but usually that's how it happens. But so the The interesting thing is that the public authorities now has a direct link with the bank sponsor or the landowner and manager if they are part of the what we call banking agreement. Next, what can we enforce? What can we require afterwards? It depends on the legal strength of the document in which the commitment are stated. It depends on the type of commitment, and it depends on the clarity of the commitments. So first, the legal strength of the offset requirement. So most importantly, what I want to say is that when you have environmental impact assessment, if you have a commitment in those, it doesn't have any legal strength. It's not a legal commitment. It's at most a moral commitment. You have to have incorporation of those obligations in permits. And so that's what the Environmental Impact Assessment Directive, the amendments, try to do again. There is an article that speaks about incorporation of the measure in the permit. That way it can be enforced afterward. The second point is the type of action. When you have either action-based requirement or outcome-based requirement. If you only have action-based requirement, like recreation, restoration, enhancement, preservation actions, without stating the particular targets that you need to reach, if you don't reach the target, you cannot enforce them because you only require from developer that they implement the management actions. So you need to have a combination of action-based and outcome-based requirement that is often called performance standards. Related to that, again, this performance standard and this action-based obligation need to be well-defined. If they're too vague, too lenient, or inappropriate, it becomes impossible to enforce, and often the result of it is that even if you comply with the permit condition, if those conditions are not well set, it's a poor indicator of the ecological success of the measures. So then the last point is, how do we enforce this obligation if we find non-compliance? Through the comparative research I have done, there is a lot of different tools, and different authorities have access to different of those tools depending on the underlying legal framework. Sometimes they are general, other legal frameworks have very specific tools tailored to biodiversity offsets. So I divided them into four stages: cooperative enforcement, coercive enforcement, economic incentives, and private enforcement. For example, citizen suit can be a good enforcement or deterrent. And the same, so cooperative, it will more be about adaptive management and pushing developers with collaboration to implement their obligation. Coercive enforcement is really pushing through strict standards. Economic incentives is to have, for example, you only release the credits once you're sure that you have reached the measure, and then enforcement I have talked about. And so I'm just have the last one. There's a complementarity of this approach. That's an important fact. That, for example, if your action-based requirements are not implemented, then you want to have deterrence of non-compliance tools. But if you're in the outcome-based, if you have a developer that did everything he could do, but it's still not reaching the performance standard, then you are in remediation tool and adaptive management. So further step is that from there, how do we test these different tools into empirical research? That would be the objective of a postdoctorate, for example. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, there in the middle.
Thank you very much. It's great to have the perspective of a lawyer on biodiversity offsetting. My question is a very concrete question regarding on-ground practices. I've noticed in my case study, I want to go back to the responsibility of the developer when you have a permit that was authorized for a project. When I went on the ground, the person doing the actual offset was a consultant, and it was really clear from the way people were talking that if there was a problem, the consultant would be the one that will have to deal with the problem. So I was wondering if, because of the limitations that we already said today, that you need the cooperation of the farmers, which is the case I'm looking at, and climate change, what happens legally if, for external reasons, the consultant can't provide the proper outcomes that they are supposed to provide in their contract with the developer? Thank you.
It depends. It's a very difficult question. It's a very interesting one. But it depends from a case-by-case basis. And again, it depends on the legal framework you are in. So in France, the answer would be different than in Australia. The problem is in France. So in France, it's going to be the if the public authority decide to go after the developer, it has to go after the developer, and then the developer will have to go to court to enforce the contract that he has in private law between the contract and the ecological consultant. So that's mostly it. Now, if it's external factors, again, it depends on how it's set.
Thank you.
So hi again. You probably know me by now, Marianne Darby from Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research in Germany. And I will, for a moment or for a bit longer moment, now leave my role as a symposium chair and be one of the presenters as well. And so I would like to share with you some research that I have conducted on the question whether there is a move in biodiversity offsetting from compliance regimes to voluntary approaches. And as I thought, there might be not only offset nerds around here, I thought to frame it a bit more generally also in terms of whether this somehow stands exemplarily for a shift in nature conservation towards voluntary environmental approaches. And I will start off with a little bit of setting a framing about voluntary environmental approaches and then present you very briefly the conceptual framework for voluntariness of biodiversity offsets and the associated typology that I have developed. So first of all, what did nature conservation in the good old times look like? This is a bit polemic. You see the very nice carrot and stick example that also you've seen outside from Seppo. And basically, very bluntly speaking, environmental regulation or command and control regulation was the thing in the 1960s, 70s, and still 1980s. Sometimes you think it's the same thing today. And so this government push approach was very much focusing also and encouraging end-of-pipe pollution control. However, this has been effective on the one hand, but on the other hand, it has also been highly criticized, especially by economists, for its lack of flexibility, but also sometimes for a bit lacking efficiency and too much capacity going into this. So you've all heard about the buzzwords of our times with natural capital, corporate social responsibilities, and the likes. And what we've seen are basically two trends. The one is starting mostly in the 1980s, a trend toward market-based instruments and increasingly economic incentives that have led to self-regulations by firms, etc. And the second thing that happened is in the 1990s, a move towards more voluntary environmental approaches as a new promising tool for future environmental policy and also as a potential alternative to traditional regulation to the carrot and stick approach. So from this, you can come up with the question whether there are new voluntary forms of environmental governance that are actually replacing traditional environmental regulation and compliance regimes. And more specifically, as I have stated in the beginning, whether there is a move in biodiversity offsetting from compliance regimes to voluntary approaches. So in the very beginning, if you've seen Joe's talk, the policy landscape of biodiversity offsetting has quite evolved over time. There are numerous approaches that date back a few decades already in different countries. I won't go into detail here. But just to mention that there has been, especially in the early 2000s, a move towards some more voluntary offsetting approaches, notably fostered by the Business and Biodiversity Offset Program and an increased engagement of the business sector. So, but the point that I want to make here is basically that there is an increasing number and diversity of biodiversity offsets that goes beyond the more well-known approaches, for example, in the U.S., in Australia and also, in, for example, in Germany. But not only a growing number and diversity, but also a growing controversy about offsets, and namely about this dichotomy of mandatory versus voluntary biodiversity offsets. And quite bluntly or colloquially speaking, mandatory offsets are often said to be bound to some sort of legal compliance, potentially subject to fines and sanctions, though this is quite tricky, and often driven by government. On the other hand, voluntary offsets are often associated with some form of corporate responsibility and established business case for biodiversity offsets and driven by businesses. However, in practice, it is not that easy, and I just want to give you two examples that highlight that this is a little bit more complicated in practice. One example is from the UK. The UK has set up a number of offsets pilots, And this was directly initiated by the UK government, but on a voluntary basis. So you have here a little contradiction. It's not legally binding, but it's a government approach. On the other hand, there are the performance standards by the International Finance Corporation, which is the private sector arm of the World Bank, so a large lending organization that finances huge development projects. And they require developers that want to get funding for their projects to comply with their standards on biodiversity offsetting. So this is not a legal requirement by government as such, but it is clearly, if you want to get the money, and as we saw also in this morning, money is something that touches people that you have to comply with. So in a way, it's a mandatory scheme, you could argue. So as you see with these two examples, the practical evidence kind of doesn't really fit under this quite strict or simplified dichotomy of mandatory versus voluntary biodiversity offsets. So against this backdrop, I tried to come up with a more diverse conceptual understanding of biodiversity offsetting, and I came up with 7 biodiversity offset types. And just as a disclaimer upfront, I see this more as a starting point, and I think that further research on this would even mean that there could be way more types out there. And the way I did it is I used an approach of empirically grounded typification, meaning that I looked into the scientific literature and derived criteria from it, but also had an empirical base. And bringing this together, I developed this framework of 7 offset types. I won't go into detail here. If you're interested, we can discuss afterwards, but I will share some first trends and conclusions in a minute. Just to illustrate that I also used some empirical validation of this conceptual base, and I did it in an explorative screening of cases worldwide, which was non-representative, and I found 72 cases worldwide that I sorted into these types. And one thing I did is I came up with a table. And when you go into details, it's also quite tricky, because then what I found that often there are motivations that are overlapping, so sometimes these also fell into different categories. And then I also displayed it in a map, which you see here. And I will give you, as I just said a minute ago, some trends on promising offset types. So first of all, there is still a dominance of regulatory offsets and offset-related legislation, but increasingly there are also now cooperative approaches, and there's a growing role of NGOs and civil society groups which encourage developers to undertake biodiversity offsets. A fourth point is that biodiversity offsets are increasingly part of business operations and business responsibility. And the example that I had mentioned earlier, lender requirements such as by the International Finance Corporation or the World Bank play an increasing role in large development projects. So to conclude, I want to get back to the question, and I couldn't stand it to take up another one of these nice illustrations by Seppo. So are new voluntary forms of environmental governance replacing traditional environmental regulation and compliance regimes? And what can be said for the case of biodiversity offsetting? Well, contrary to what the ice bear shows here, in practice it is rather not black and white, but what I found with my typology is that this is opening up rather a whole spectrum of many shades of gray and different types in between these two, let's say, edges of voluntariness, voluntary and mandatory biodiversity offsets. And in practice, things are highly context dependent. And so we have to say bye-bye carrots and sticks and face complexity, and that there are different approaches out there adapted to different context situations. One point that I briefly want to stress, that this has also implications on the roles and responsibilities of actors. And I have taken out here the role of governments, because this has been quite central in the past. And often reduced to the role of regulator or enforcing authority. But when you look at it through this framework of different offset types, governments can actually play a quite diverse role under these different settings. For example, also through enabling pilot schemes and providing incentives and guidance, but also in structuring governance processes, facilitating and mediating processes at national level, or as general as providing baseline data and setting strategic nature conservation goals. So yes, to briefly come to an end, biodiversity offsetting is not merely a narrow liberal market-based instrument applied by businesses, so it's not only about market-based instrument, but rather it is also a tool in environmental policy to underpin and reach nature conservation goals. And as I have said, I would call for a more differentiated and less generalized approach to both the public and the policy debate for context and specific conclusions on biodiversity offsets. And as I have just said, also a more sophisticated understanding of the role of different actors and stakeholders, notably the role of governments. So most of importantly, voluntary biodiversity offsets, or to scale this up a bit to voluntary environmental approaches, are not replacing traditional environmental regulation, but rather they are complementary, and voluntary environmental approaches may even be more successful when backed by an underlying regulatory framework. So with this, I would like to thank you and looking forward to your questions very briefly. Oh, I guess I'm in my double position again, so any quick questions from the audience? Well, everything's clear. That's quite nice. Okay, yeah. Yeah, Joe.
I didn't get to answer your question when we were having the discussion before, and I just really wanted to emphasize the point that you made about differentiating the debate and not making it about generalizations, but more about specific examples and specific different scenarios. I think that's a really good way of answering that question, is to say that we shouldn't have a general debate. I think we should have a debate that's specific to different areas or habitats, sort of policy drivers and so forth. I think it's a really good point that you made. So it's not really a question.
Yeah, but thanks for making the point anyway. And it's good that now we had time that you didn't get out of this tricky question and you get to respond to it. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for a very interesting presentation. I wanted to have your point of view, but the fact that do you think that in the countries where we have regulatory offsets, we would have more and more voluntary approaches too? Is it a trend that is appearing in other countries, or is it also something that is emerging from countries with a regulatory approach of offsets?
Well, I think there are two different things, and usually it's also a question of scale. For example, the offset system that we're having in Germany, there are a lot of, you know, like small-scale impacts, and they're regulated. But there is an aspect also of voluntariness in there, because we do have this voluntary offset service provision system, which in a way, the offset service provider, that's a whole voluntary system, but then there is a connection to the mandatory system that they use. Okay, so we're coming to the last presentation of our symposium, and the reason why you're still seeing me up here is basically not because I've transformed to Reike Hauser, but Reike from the European Commission, she unfortunately couldn't be here, and she tried to brief me as good as she could to convey her message on her behalf. So I'm very happy that she managed, she sent her presentation, and then we will have a little bit to conclude this symposium, the policy perspective after having some science perspective and also some practitioners' perspective. And as you might have recognized, the title has also slightly changed, and the focus will be on the role of the mitigation hierarchy in the upcoming EU guidance on integrating ecosystems and their services into decision making. So the idea of including offsetting into EU policy was anchored in the 2020 biodiversity strategy of the EU with its headline target to halt the loss of biodiversity and ecosystems in the EU by 2020 and to reverse it to the extent possible while also contributing to global efforts to curb biodiversity loss. And this is operationalized in 6 targets. And for the issue of biodiversity offsetting, we need to zoom in on target 2, on protecting and restoring ecosystems and their services. And this more specifically includes actions to strengthen knowledge through the mapping and assessment of ecosystems and their services and natural capital accounting. Also, restoration and the establishment of green infrastructure, and more importantly, it includes Action 7B on an initiative for no net loss. And to give you a little bit of background, this initiative that had been envisaged to be put in place by 2015 was envisaged as an initiative to ensure there is no net loss of ecosystems and their services, e.g. through compensation or offsetting. So that was a bit of a, the strategy there. And this so-called no-net loss initiative was underpinned by various actions on the way towards this with some studies that had been commissioned, but also a public consultation in 2015, which was a bit, let's say, unbalanced between very different takes on this whole initiative. And due to this, both this public consultation, but also the ongoing policy discourse and different interfering factors, this initiative had first been postponed and developed finally into something new. And one of the interfering or things that were going on the policy side was the midterm review of the biodiversity strategy. And this basically concluded that there were local success stories, but overall a continued loss of biodiversity and ecosystem services. And notably, challenges remained related to implementation, policy integration, financing, and specifically are on knowledge and awareness of human dependencies on nature. So the conclusion was basically that more efforts were needed to reach the targets and that more integrated efforts would be needed. In addition, there was also the fitness check of the EU Nature Directive, so the Birds and Habitats Directives, ongoing, and this concluded in December 2016, that the directives were fit for purpose, but that improvements in their implementations are dearly needed to ensure that they can deliver their full potential. So in response to this, as I have said, the conclusion was that something more integrative across all these targets would need to be set up rather than this very singular approaches like, for example, the No Net Loss Initiative. So in response, an action plan for nature, people, and the economy was adopted in April 2017, and it includes 15 actions and more than 100 measures under 4 priority areas. And I just want to focus here on action one, and this action one is on improving guidance and knowledge. And under action one, there's the development of EU guidance on integrating ecosystems and their services into decision making envisaged, and this guidance will incorporate inter alia the mitigation hierarchy with an added emphasis on enhancing ecosystem resilience to achieve also a wider range of socioeconomic benefits. So as you see, offsetting and compensation has now moved from the initial idea of a more specific standalone no net loss initiative to something more integrated into a wider action plan and an ecosystem services initiative. So in a nutshell, this ecosystem services initiative is envisaged for later in 2018, and this is still in the policy negotiation. So what I present here are basically the ideas that the Commission and especially DG Environment has here, which are nonetheless quite consolidated already. So this will be a non-binding guidance for decision makers and planners. It will also have will be strongly based on a knowledge base of the EU mapping and assessment of ecosystem services. And the objective will be to encourage sector integration of ecosystem services, basically by raising awareness of synergies between preserving and enhancing ecosystems and socioeconomic objectives, but also providing guidance for policy uptake of knowledge and tools and encouraging learning by doing. So the main elements of this ecosystem services guidance will be that there will be guiding principles, and I will focus on these guidance principles now, but there will also be some crucial follow-up actions in terms of dissemination, but also workshops, further work in key areas is envisaged, such as in urban areas or marine areas. And first workshops are already planned to be held in autumn this year. So coming to some guidance principles, I want to stress that obviously there will be full respect of the existing legislation and conservation objectives and a focus on the precautionary principle. And the major point that I want to raise here is the importance of the enhancing the resilience before then coming to the mitigation hierarchy of avoiding damage, mitigating, and compensating. This new ecosystem services initiative and the related guidance does present a number of opportunities. And these, I want to briefly mention a few opportunities that arise specifically in applying the mitigation hierarchy to ecosystem services. So as I have mentioned, the links between ecosystem resilience and the delivery of a broad range of services are quite crucial. So the new approach is really not to focus on single individual services, but rather on a whole bundle of services, and thus also making a socioeconomic case for enhancing ecosystems. So this then also means addressing social aspects of fairness and equality and an increasing stakeholder engagement. One very important point that we're often discussing and reference has been made to protected biodiversity and Natura 2000 already, whether we focus with offsetting on protected areas or this is a no-go, or whether we really focus on the ordinary, everyday landscape and biodiversity. And here a clear point is made that more attention needs to be paid also to ordinary biodiversity. So I would like to also come to conclude with some challenges that also arise when applying the mitigation hierarchy to ecosystem services. First of all, certain ecosystem services may not be well visible, and the idea is also that with this guidance and with this initiative, they will be more explicit and visible. The second is that knowledge gaps need to be dealt with, particular in understanding the links between ecosystem conditions and the delivery of services. And another point that still persists, and we've been touching upon that several times, is on different valuation and assessment methodologies for biodiversity offsetting. In particular, one very tricky one, considering also the limitations of monetary valuation techniques. And a few points that have been raised also earlier, the location of the impact, which is quite crucial. And finally, also the question of how to deal with trade-offs. So, as I have said earlier, basically this new shift from a more offset-focused known and loss initiative to a wider ecosystem services initiative is basically a shift towards moving towards the bigger picture. So no standalone no net loss initiative, but rather an integrative ecosystem services initiative with links to other instruments. And as such, I just want to mention links to, for example, the EU Pollinators Initiative, which has recently been published, but also the upcoming guidance on the strategic EU-level green and blue infrastructure, which is expected for later this year. So with this, I thank you on behalf of Rijke, and I have on the very first slide, there's also her email address, so you can also reach out to her via email for any further information or have your comments and questions right now, and I will try to answer on her behalf. Thanks.
Hi, thank you for your talks. My question relates to the use of the mitigation hierarchy, and this is in relation to this presentation, but generally regarding all of the presentations today. From my experience researching the use of biodiversity offsets in Australia, when I was speaking to a former regulator, they were very cynical about the use of the mitigation hierarchy and said that particularly for large charismatic projects, developers have no interest in going through the process of the mitigation hierarchy and they want to jump straight to compensation and to biodiversity offsets. So I wonder if you have anything to say about that, whether that's been your experience looking at offsets in the EU, and perhaps if you have any thoughts on how to deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely answer to this only more or less from my perspective as a researcher and from the German perspective. And I definitely think that in the very first place, and that's also a question that I always raise, it's important to really seriously consider the development priorities, and that offsets are only something that is supposed to happen once this decision is made anyway, that these development priorities are inevitable. So still, I know this is sometimes a little bit idealistic or theoretical, that there are quite some cases in practice where this seems to be happening the other way around, that because there is an offset, some development decisions might be pursued. But this is always a very, very tricky process in practice. But I would say that, again, speaking from the German perspective, if you have a system in place also, and I see here the authorities have a very strong role to play, this helps a lot.